This is the third talk in the series of five talks on time. And this talk is entitled Time and the Ending of Suffering. So it's an interesting why we would equate time with suffering. And so we have to understand that when we talk about time, it's a little bit like trying to talk about water to a fish. You know, it's just that we're so enveloped in it that it feels almost impossible to get some perspective of it. It feels like that's just the way we move in life, is in time. And may I say that we're not talking about physical time, time by the clock, because that has its own peculiarities. But we're talking about inward time, the compulsion to think ahead of ourselves or bring back memories and regrets and hold ourselves accountable to our previous moments and hold ourselves within some kind of tension to the expectation of the unfolding of this moment. And we're so used to thinking in terms of that. In fact, as I mentioned in the previous talk, thought is time. It's not, I can't say thought induces time or thought brings time forth. Thought is time. So as long as we are a thought-based species, then we are going to be thinking in time. And it's so hard to think that there could be a different way to be, a different universe available to us besides this one in which we are constantly weighing in on the decisions we make and regretting those decisions and looking with expectation and anticipation of decisions that we haven't, of moments that we haven't lived yet. So the basic quandary of this particular subject is if we want our image and the content of our lives, then we will suffer. So you get one, you get the other. And the talk will be the explanation of why that is true. If you want, which is what the whole thing is about, the propulsion or the need to continue ourselves forth, to carry ourselves forth, the same self that we remembered just a moment ago, to continue that, the compelling need to continue the duration of me, of my sense of self forward, will inevitably lead to some conflict. Now let's just look at it in terms that may or may not make some sense experientially. The fact is, you know, you may not know this fact, but the fact is that if we release our thinking, we fall into a world of unification, of non-differentiation. It doesn't mean that you aren't there isn't a moving organism here. There is a moving organism here. It's just not separate from the rest of life at all in terms of differentiating itself. So when we think of ourselves as being separate or being differentiated from, in order to hold that particular idea, there has to be some friction or conflict with reality. Because how could we hold ourselves in a way that isn't true and not have some backlash from the truth or from that particular sense of individuation? To individualize ourselves and to individualize others and to individualize life means that we have to hold it with a certain degree of tension against what it really is. We have to weigh in and keep reassuring mentally, constricting something or separating it out so that it doesn't fall back into the fold of life. So already we see that when we do this, when we live in such a manner with an image and content, that there is some kind of way that we are in friction to life and what life really is. And the definition of how strongly we believe in our image is another way that we are destined to be in contraction around that image. For instance, I was just reading an interview with Jennifer Capriati, who is a young tennis player. I think she's 20. But she started playing as almost a child prodigy on the professional circuit at like something age like 12 or 13. So she was out there hitting with the women twice her age and has been fairly accomplished in tennis. But last year she got a shoulder injury and she hasn't been able to play and may never be able to play again, according to this article. And the article was not about so much about her shoulder injury as about the psychological backlash from not playing tennis when she has defined herself as being a tennis player since she as early as she could remember. And she said that at times she was suicidal because she said she only knew herself and other people only knew her as a tennis player. And therefore, when that was taken away, what was left? What was left is not worth living for because the image was so strong and so meaningful in terms of her idea of being a tennis player. So you can see how the idea that we form about ourselves can have an overriding primary concern psychologically for who we are in the world as well as what other people, we think other people know of us. And so we're not to take this lightly. This is not a small, minor Dharma point. It's really huge. But it's helpful to remember that image, that the sense of me is just a thought about me. Well, if she would let go of the thought of her being a tennis player, how much would really be taken away from her? In this moment, if you were to release your idea of whatever holds you in place, individuated and differentiated from those around us, if we were just to release the ideas that we think separate us so firmly and securely from one another, what would remain, you see? And is that a scary? Is that scary? Are we frightened by that prospect? Or are we encouraged by that? Does our heart think, well, let's see, well, I wonder what that would be like? Or does that sound like insanity somehow? Like not knowing who you would be? Or somehow having our edges so vague that we wouldn't really be able to navigate through the world? Well, none of that is true. We don't do it from insanity. We don't do it to try to get over ourselves because of a self in pain. We don't do it because we hate who we are. We do it because we're tuned to the tension and the pain of constantly reassuring ourselves moment after moment that I'm a tennis player, that people know me by that and only that. And if we lead with that, right? Like when you meet somebody, when you first meet them, your first questions often indicate where it is that our image rests. In this area of the country, I suppose it would be, what do you do for a living? Where I came from in Texas many years ago was, what church did you go to? And those defining moments of image creation, of how I hold the world and how I hold myself within the world, are all have to do with time, because they're the memories of myself. They're what I have learned from my past and how to keep myself differentiated, how I keep myself known to others and known to myself. So this, remember throughout this whole talk series that thought is time. That time doesn't exist without thinking. Because where is time? Where is time past? Where is time future? With, when you're not thinking, there isn't any. It's only when we bring forth the thought of the past that we have a whole sense of disposition in the present. And it's only when we think about where this present is going to take us that we have a kind of anxiety or worry or busyness or some sense of anticipation as to where the next moment is going to evolve. So without that need to foster and fester within thinking, what would we be? What would we be? Where would we be without time? Where would we be? It's an interesting question, and I hope some of us pursue it enough to find out, because that really is the end of suffering. It's not some philosophical tale, so philosophical question. It really is what the ultimate form of awakening, the ultimate expression of awakening is the release from time, to live in the timeless, to live undifferentiated. Again, I can hear our fears backlash from that. If he thinks I'm going to become a nobody, well, I'm not suggesting you become anything. I'm suggesting you release the need to become. This is not a new becoming. It's releasing what we've already become. Finding out what is authentic within our life, because what we have told ourselves from our past is inauthentic. It's what we have believed or nurtured. But it isn't what is authentically here. What is authentically here is what's here when we're not grasping at anything, when we're not trying to form ourselves into any particular position, style, personality, character at all. And as I've mentioned in past talks, I explain the difference between the undifferentiated, which I call the y-axis, and the differentiated, thought-induced, time-centered world, which I call the x-axis. And it's so different, it's so difficult to even conceive that we could live without the struggle and conflict and contraction that we live in the world that is induced through our thinking, through our belief in time, past time, present time, future, and how discontent we find ourselves because we can never settle. We're always thinking ahead of ourselves or bringing forth what has been in the past, never really settling in. So this sense of suffering has to be fully exposed to the concept of time and how time creates it and how it is alleviated when we release the need to think. I don't mean that thought doesn't have a place in life. Of course it does. But when we are directed by thought rather than informed by thought, even in perhaps many of your practice, you know already that thought is just one, in Buddhism, it's called one of the six sense doors. It's not me, and then the other five senses come into thinking. Thought itself is another door of data that comes in, like smells, taste, touch, physical sensation, and whatever the other ones I forgot are. Thought is another, is the sixth sense, not ESP, and that not extrasensory perception, but is a door, it's a sense door into awareness. And so when we're quiet enough in ourselves, we can actually see all six senses operating completely. And then within the wholeness of that, we can let thought inform the situation, but not direct the situation. So that we can, if we know we needed to get back home, and we had to read a map and follow the directions. All that is completely there for us to be able to do. Our memory doesn't suddenly go blank. The knowledge that we have learned and based ourselves within is there for use when it's needed. But when it's only the knowledge from which we see the world, when there is no other space around that knowledge, no other way that we can form the world except through our thinking, then that shows that we are time-driven and only time-driven, that there's no way for us to be able to step out of time when we are totally caught into the mind and the workings of the mind. Now, it's an interesting thing about suffering. Suffering sounds a little heavy-toned, but just because it's used in most of the Buddhist literature, I'll continue to use it in this talk. But there's a purpose to it. It has to be flawed, this universe of our own creation. It has to be flawed. You know, there has to be that one flaw in it. Because it's actually extraordinarily imaginative. We imagine each other. We imagine ourselves. We imagine all the things. We have rules associated with it. We have motivating and purposeful living and intentional living. And we have things that are meaningful and things that aren't. We have a whole polarity of good and evil and this and that and ups and downs. All of that is completely formed by and through the world of thinking. And so we've made this enormously rich vocabulary associated with our living experience. And it would be perfect, except it has a flaw. And that flaw is that it's not real. And therefore, because it's a mental created world, and rather than the actual one, which I will call the fact or reality, the fact of how reality is actually going ultimately is on a collision course with our imaginative reality and how we want it to go. And therefore, these two have to keep colliding. And when they collide, we call that suffering. And so the flaw shows us that we are doing something wrong. And for a long period of time, we can accommodate that flaw through external blame and say, you know, it's not my flaw, it's the guy next door to me who has the barking dog. It's his flaw, not my flaw. And we can keep ourselves pretty flawless, can't we? Well, at some point that doesn't work anymore. And hopefully all of us have reached some degree of understanding where we can't blame that on anyone. And we have to see the flaws, not of ourselves, because that's where we would like to go. We'd like to say, yes, I'm a flawed being, I'm no good. Because that's psychologically, we're ready to receive that. But we can't do that because even with a little introspection, you see there's no one there to blame it on. So you can't point backward and you can't point forward. We have to see that how this reality is being created is flawed. I'm not flawed and you're not flawed. How the reality is being created is flawed. Now that's the last, we won't challenge our reality. We don't want to challenge our reality. It's our bedrock. It's our foundation. We don't want to challenge thought. We don't want to challenge time. We want to ask questions from time. When we ask questions from time, those questions sound like, how do I get over this problem? What do I do about this problem? They sound like ways to use time to get around the obstacle that we have created with time. Do you see that? Now that's asking questions from the reality. What a mystic, if I can use that term, what a Buddhist meditator, somebody who's truly interested in transformation, self-transformation, starts asking questions about the reality they're in. And that's what we're doing tonight. We're asking questions about the nature of reality, about a time-focused, created reality, thought-driven. And so these questions are much more, they have much more resistance to them, because they mean pulling the rug out from virtually the foundation on which we live, the very sense of being who and what we are. But I like those kind of things. If the thing is flawed and if it isn't true, pull the rug out. I don't want to stand there forever. Let's get on with it. Let's get on with what is true. Let's stand here and pretend for the rest of my life. Pretend I'm somebody. Pretend you're somebody. Dying, pretending. What do you want to do that for? Let's figure this whole thing out and see really what is true. What is really true. And I think suffering has its motivating aspect towards asking questions about the reality we're in. Why else would we? If we were all humming along here and there was no perceivable flaw and we could stay on our heads for the rest of our life, why ask any question at all? Just kind of move along. In the Buddhist cosmology, they say that there are deva realms where all of the struggles and contractions are so minimal. I don't believe they can be absent, because as long as there's any individuation, there has to be some struggle. But anyway, there's so much joy and pleasure in those realms that nobody ever wants to get out of them. And that the human realm is the perfect realm in which we can ask questions, because there's a mixture of pain and pleasure sufficient for us to not be completely content within this lifestyle, this flawed lifestyle that we are dreaming. Now, so I'm also seeing, you know, that what life does to us over time is to present situations, occurrences, karmic occurrences that force the pain of our hiding out front. So we always blame, I mean, that's where our blame comes in. We get fired from the job, or we break up with a long established partner, or we get a tumor early in our years, or whatever. That's life trying to show us the flaw that we have been living with. And it only has one way to do that, and that's through the suffering that we endure. I don't want to make this too, other, because we're doing it really to ourselves. We're doing it to ourselves. In any case, I can begin to see now that the whole culture, the whole world is having to move to a crisis, and I don't understand it, but it may have something to do with a quantum leap in our evolution, in our spiritual evolution. Because if you look back in your history of what got you involved spiritually, quite likely there was an issue of despair or pain that was so acute that you finally had to seek other ways to deal with it than the ones you've been using. So too, culture might be at a crisis point now in which they are forced to look at the world in a completely different set of parameters, completely different way of perceiving. And that will force it, perhaps, to move quantum leap to the next way of being. I'm hoping, if that's inevitable, that there is an inevitable crisis. I'm not hoping that there's an inevitable crisis, but I'm hoping if there is an inevitable crisis, that that's the result of the crisis. Because it seems like that's the only way that as a culture we can have our attention focused. So let's just look for a moment at time and suffering and use some practical examples so that it doesn't get too theoretical. I don't want it to be theoretical. What is your thought theoretical? Is your pain theoretical? It's not theoretical. If we can't begin to understand how one causes the other, where's the link? Where's the link back to our meditation practice? So let's just take an opportunity to just take a practical example. Say we wake up in the morning with a stiff back, and it's just one of those nagging components of being alive and perhaps aging. Except this one just doesn't go away after a few days, and we think, oh, this could be serious, is the thought we start giving it. So now we've increased the amplitude of our worry, haven't we? Because the thought ignites a particular emotional pattern that's associated with severity. Now thought, get a sense here how thought and emotional patterns follow suit. They really feed one another. So the thought, a very ordinary and sane thought, starts the whole process. Oh, I have a stiff back, which is a relative truth about back and stiffness, and there's no real worry about that until we reach a threshold in which it can't be accounted for as just a normal stiff back. It must be something else. Now there's a ratcheting up of the emotion. The emotion comes into the thought, and that the worry, my God, this may be more serious than what I thought. Then that stimulates, the emotion stimulates worried thinking. Worried thinking no longer is rational thinking. It now has its own flight into the imaginative world. Like, you know, this could be a tumor, or this could be the aggravation of an old injury or wound that I had, and if that's the case, then I'm going to have it on and on and on. And as we go through the process of finding out what it is, the emotion either ratchets down because it's been given a normal perspective, interpretation, or it ratchets up because it takes on the next step. And the doctor looks at it and says, God, I don't know what's wrong with you. Whoa! Now we're in the next level. And our thoughts follow suit, inviting an exploration of intense suffering associated with intense worry and fear. What is driving the suffering associated with the pain? The pain is no different than the pain I woke up with a week earlier and felt stiffness. At that point, there was no suffering because the thoughts and worry weren't associated with it. Same stiffness, same physical sensation that was there from day one. It's just that now it has increased in its tension around worry. And what has happened is that the suffering is directly proportional to the flight that thought has taken. It's no longer grounded with the fact of the stiffness. It's now taken flight into the worry of an unknown ailment. Probably, in our minds, associated with worry, with a limited prognosis. And I can see myself now in hospice care. That's the way it goes. In fact, I had a nurse friend who was a hospice nurse, one of the finest hospice nurses I ever worked with, and she got a lump in her breast. And she said the 4 days or 5 days or however long it took between the time when she had her lump biopsy and found out it was benign, which brought it all back down to sanity. And those 4 days, she went through the most turbulent hell of her life. In fact, because she was a hospice nurse and knew the implications and all of that, she was already selecting the hospice staff that she wanted to visit her. That's where the mind goes. See, you can't coil it back. You can't reel it back in. Once we have allowed it to move away from the fact of stiffness and the sanity of the acknowledgement of what that stiffness is, the sane acknowledgement, oh, my back is stiff. Once it has moved beyond that, and it has taken it's like somebody taking a high dive on a high diving board and jumps down and pushes the board down, and now that we're in flight off, you know, and it's in that flight, we're no longer grounded, we're no longer on the ground, we are now taking flight into the imaginative. And the imaginative is where suffering occurs. Suffering doesn't occur on the ground. Suffering doesn't occur with the fact. See, isn't that interesting? Do you understand why the Buddha and teachers from a millennium have encouraged groundedness in this practice? Feet on the ground. Go first to the body. Stay with the body. Don't let the mind take us away from the body. Because that's where the sane, non-suffering relationship to whatever it is that's occurring can be discovered. But once the mind leaves the ground, it is almost impossible to reel it back in. I had somebody call me one time at some ungodly hour, like 2 a.m., from, I don't know, some place across the country from where I lived. They got my name, I don't know how. And they called me, and they were just in frantic panic, just because I don't remember even what, but they were just in some kind of lump that they had discovered or something. I don't remember. And I said, listen, please put the person on the phone that had to look up my number, that had the sanity to find my number. I don't want to speak to this person. I want to speak to the person. Because I couldn't speak to this person. It was far gone. She was on the high dive. Far from any groundedness of being. But she had, somewhere there, she had to be really sane in discovering and finding my number. Bring that person to bear. Get in touch with that person again. So this sensation creates a thought, and then the thought has an emotional reaction. This emotional reaction, by the way, wherever we are weakest in our psyche, that's the emotional pattern that will spring forth when we are caught in an unknown. And for many people, it can be grief or whatever emotional pattern, whatever way that we have lived our life in the attitudinal way we have lived our life, with all of its insanity, that's what will couple itself or hook itself to this emotional expression associated with a thought. And then we start becoming increasingly activated around the history, our history associated with that pattern of thinking. So the thought has a whole history component with it. And how we have looked at ourselves or seen ourselves or feared for ourselves, and that comes rushing forward to fill the vacuum of not knowing. We fill the vacuum of not knowing with the patterns we have lived with our life. I mean, look at your life. When you are in the most vulnerable state, what leaps out? The patterns you most believe in. The most, unfortunately, neurotic patterns we have lived with. And then the sense of I gathers its momentum from the history of that momentum, and it's convinced, you know, in time, I am convinced, now it just becomes so delineated because it has time behind it, backing it, reinforcing its every movement. Not only is it this moment, but all my past attitudinal way, this confirms me. Wow, it's tiring just to talk about it. But it really is like that. Isn't it? The desire to end the pain, you see. Now we also have a desire to end the pain. And if we happen to be a control freak, which many of us are, then by God, we're going to get to the end of this thing. We're going to put a stop to this. We're going to make sure our back is... You're telling me it's a lump and you don't know what it is. I'm going to somebody else. I'm going to... You know, and you just... Those old patterns, you just play them out. We just play them out. What law in reality says this has to stop? Where's that law? What law says we can't get sick? that we have to be well our whole life. Please show me that law. That's an imaginative law, as are most of the laws that we work with. Fairness. It's not fair. I'm young. The average age is 79 when people die, and I'm 30. Show me that law. That's not written anywhere. See, the entry point where we can enter our own process. Now, I know you've heard from lots of teachers that the unpleasant, pleasant or unpleasantness of an experience is often the best entry point. Well, that's fine if you are on retreat or in a monastery where you can, you know, have such refined focus that you can notice the pleasant and unpleasant expression of each experience. But may I say, for most of us living an active life, emotion is our entry point. Our emotional response is our entry point. It's there we can plummet to sanity if we're willing. But we have to go through a lot of thoughts because we're midair here. I mean, when you touch the board, that's where things feel pleasant or unpleasant. But once you've decided on the way that this pleasant or unpleasant is going to express itself, then we're up in the air. So that's why people suggest, you know, okay, notice the pleasant or unpleasant. But that doesn't mean we can't enter the emotion and bring some sanity here. We just have to become comfortable with our emotional life and not bring the historical baggage of our trauma with us. Just look at this thing. Get into our bodies. Let us be embodied in this moment. Bring some sanity. Pause. Bring some sanity. Let me feel, where does the emotion feel felt in my body? I can feel this. I don't have to, it doesn't have to be this. Let me feel the stiffness in my back, just as a sensation. So this sense of emotion embodied in thought, leading to our past memories associated with similar attitudes, is the movement of time through us. And it's not just physical sensations that lead to that. It's like when we feel, some of us might feel lonely. For now, for someone who's just moving along and you feel a moment of loneliness, there's nothing so difficult about that. It doesn't even lead to much thinking. It's just a feeling. And the less thinking, the more it's dealt with as itself. And it ends very quickly. But if we're given to feeling, having abandonment issues, and we feel lonely, then that's a weak part of our psyche. And out from loneliness comes a whole plethora, a whole display of thought associated with those abandonment issues. And now I'll never be known or liked, and I'm cut off, and I'm just so desperate. And then it just ratchets up the whole situation so that we are now completely, we're not just lonely anymore, but we're fearful, we're despairing, perhaps angry. And there are many emotions that come through us that have a whole accumulative baggage associated with them. For instance, just to name two, grief and shame. Grief is an accumulative experience. If we feel grief, it may not have anything to do with what we have just seen. What we have just seen is the conditioned way that it accesses the accumulation of grief we have, the repository of grief that many of us carry with us. But grief, my God, brings back memories of lost this or separated that or orphanages or whatever. If we have a whole baggage associated, rather than just feeling grief, it's the time element that creates the suffering, not the feeling, not the emotion, not the stiff back. I hope everybody's getting that fact. It's time, not the fact. The fact is just the fact. But if we have a propensity to look upon ourselves in a discouraging way in which we're guilt-ridden, then the slightest little thing that goes wrong brings up that sense of shame and we're looking uphill at life again. Instead of just feeling it and not taking our step out of time, not letting time rush through us like a flash flood, just taking a step out of this thing. And even if the flash flood comes, it goes, and it's gone. As long as we're embodied, as long as we stay embodied. But many of us feel so convinced that we are a shameful being that we feel we should have shame in order to do penance. We want the suffering, kind of like carrying the cross. We want the suffering in order to be able to, I don't know, do penance for the whatever we've done. The sense of non-forgiveness is one of the most devastating components in which what that invites time and thought. You see? So knowing your psyche is essential. Knowing the patterns that we live with. Getting to know those. Getting to know what arises when certain conditions are present, like a physical ailment, and the fear response. Getting to know that and stepping out of time with that. Right at the intersection of that X and Y crossing. God. I'm on page one. So we perpetuate the conflict by investing truth into our emotions based upon what? Based upon what they have been in the past and meant to us in the past. You see, stepping out of time is stepping out of ourselves. Being willing, having the courage to step out of our past. You don't step out of the past by fighting it. You just let it, it's like a windstorm. You can stand straight in a windstorm and it blows and then it's gone. It's just the past coming through the present. As long as we're at the intersection of where the past meets the present can hold the past. But if we are embedded in the past, then the present just is washed with the past. And we move right through it. So we have to be embedded in the present for us to be able to hold the past as the past comes through the present. Because the past has to come through the present. It has to, because it is the present moment. It's where it's happening. There's nowhere else the past could be happening except in the present. So if we can just get that relationship squared away, then the past won't carry us away down the tunnel. And we can feel it, and we can feel the tendencies we've always had to move in accordance with the attitudes and dispositions and neurotic weak points and all of that. And yet there's something in us more sane than just being flooded away. And that sanity is what is finding my name in the phone book. That part of you. And every one of us has access to that part of ourselves. Every one of us here has access to knowing what is occurring as it's occurring. Every one of us, if we just invest in the sanity of the knowing of what's occurring rather than in the belief of what's occurring, that's all the differentiation, that's all the space we need to put an end to time. If we're willing. Because the timeless doesn't fight with time. Because from the point of view of the timeless, time is irrelevant. Because it's not happening. It's a wish. It's an imaginative wish. It's a sense door. It's like believing that you're the dog that you hear. Or the tree you see. Now you're believing the thought you are. It's the same thing. So it neither encourages nor discourages the problem. It makes it irrelevant. It doesn't treat it as real. Because there's something else that is, that we will never know when we base ourselves in time. Because time camouflages it, obscures it. It's that zero point. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? Should have made this a three-talk talk. So a little saying from Rabindranath Tagore, Indian poet. He said, the butterfly counts not months, but moments, and has sufficient time. So anyone who would like to ask any questions or comments about anything tonight, very willing to spend some time here. And sure. It's by Rabindranath Tagore. It says, the butterfly counts not months, but moments, and has sufficient time. Maybe I should have kept talking. Anyone? Yes, Suze. Please.
Of earlier in the talk about when we get so hooked by either what will be the future or the past, how hard it is to get out of it.
Yes.
And then later on, reminding us that we all have the capacity at any moment
yes.
to find that point of groundedness and sanity.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Well, her question has to do with whether it's a paradox or a contradiction about at one point in the talk I mentioned how difficult it is to get out of the world, the universe that thought has created, and yet we all have the capacity to be able to do that. In fact, we do have the capacity to end time at any sequence in time. The more elaborate our scenario, our story has become, the more difficult it is to extract ourselves from it. For instance, when I can stay with just the example I was using with the stiff back and stay with the stiffness and watch how fear is trying to make something more out of it, then it's very easy to work with the fear component from the sense of not knowing, knowing that the fear doesn't know is just trying to, ratchet up exaggerate on what is here. But once I let fear have its truth, once I give myself over to fear, and I'm seeing myself having tumors and in hospice care, then there is so much hyperbole and exaggeration and terror, because fear has now ratcheted up even its own expression, that for someone to pull one back into the body at that moment is more difficult to do than when it is in its earlier stages of it. I have done it, though. There was a time when I was working with dying patients, and even as someone was dying, often unable to speak, I would say to them, which I think must be a very hyperbole time. I mean, you know, you're losing everything. And yet I could see, I would ask them, you feel, you know, the body is dying, and they would acknowledge it or not. And then I would say, is there something in you that isn't dying? Is there something in you that cannot die? And sometimes, occasionally, there would be a kind of a serenity or a smile that would come on the patient's face. So I know that there is a way to come out of whatever is happening, even in the most dire situations, if there is enough compulsion, that's the wrong word, if there's enough intention to do so. Now, as Buddhists, meditators, as people who are really trying to use our lives for our practice, we have to invite or invest in the entry point being our emotions. Because that's what's most obvious in our daily life. We don't have to wait, though, until they get so encumbered with our story and the tragedies therein. We can start picking up emotional subtlety as we move through the day, little pieces of loneliness or despair that happen. And at their first glimpse, we can get very emotionally attuned to ourselves. And that keeps the whole thing from losing its relevance in that moment. And that's very possible and very workable for us to do that. So just the entry of what is being felt in this moment. Often there is where we are just about ready to take the high dive. It so comes very quick, though, if we're not careful, because from that moment of fear or loneliness or despair, the psyche is just waiting to jump out, leap out with its story of tragedy. The more tragic we can become within our story, unfortunately, the more we know ourselves from our story. And the more known we are, the more this reality takes its truth. The less we invite our story into our lives, the less separate we feel. And correspondingly, the happier we feel, the more joyful we feel. So the sense of joy is directly or indirectly proportional to our heightened story. And some of us are drama wallows. We love that because we really love having the world be miserable in the world. You know, that's how we have known ourselves, and that's how we welcome the world and our place in it. Fine, if we want to do that, but for God's sake, at least look at the downside, the flaw of living in such a way. Just look at the flaw. You don't have to stop living that way, but if you study the flaw, you'll want to. And the wanting to change has to come from each of us. It can't be induced or directed from the outside.
Can you talk a little bit about how you can hold the difference between releasing energy and energy that feels like you're just giving up? Because when I'm sort of in this high dive, it doesn't feel like I'm releasing. It feels like I'm just giving up. Like I'm just, you know, losing. I'm just going to let it go, whatever.
Right,
I don't know sort of how to hold the energy of this.
No, I get you. It feels like you're not doing anything and that's just disempowering, and you have this, you have your anger, and you're just supposed to watch it. What does watching do? That's not doing anything. I'm being passive to it. You see, those are the insidious messages of mind. You have to be very careful, because the mind wants you, the last thing it wants from you is observation. It wants you to be active in it. It wants you to take it as a problem and act upon the problem. And it's a long time before we can, when we understand the power of presence over reactivity. Why just being present to reactivity is sufficient. So you have first get it theoretically, and then you can begin to move experientially into the theory. All right. So the theory is that the past in that moment is just playing forth, and it has such enormous momentum that it wants to reinvite and renew activity, meaningful activity within anger or despair or whatever. And therefore, the last thing it wants to do is be non-productive, to just be passive in that. It feels like it's giving over to the energy. But giving over to the energy is exactly what needs to be done. Because at the zero point between where we are yet to be formed from this passing energy, for us to just be able to sit and observe it, we are inviting a completely different relationship to the energy that seems to be telling us to do something. When it seems to be telling us to do something, we have no choice but to do it. But when we can feel the energy coming through and what it seems to be telling us to do, and we can sense that that is not necessary, because why? What would it do? I mean, like, walk it back and say, if I have a problem and I try to force something on this problem, is that going to at all, will I ever have a different relationship to this problem at all? No, you're just meeting force with force, and you can't find contentment by meeting force with force.
So this would be like when you're sitting and some energy shows up, and you just sort of sit there and watch the energy and
right.
You know, whatever
right.
happens with it, and you don't start thinking into the energy.
Right. That's right. That's right. When you've thought into the energy, then you're in it, and the compulsion is to do something about the energy. So now you have two things. You have the energy and the compelling need to do something about it that you're facing. And that's what makes it so difficult. But it's such a wonder of doing nothing. You see, it's absolutely the simplest thing you could possibly do, isn't it? Isn't it? It's not asking anything from you. Isn't that beautiful? In science, they call it the law of parsimony or parsimony, where it's so beautiful. It's so beautifully represented. The law that's in front of us and the way to work with this law is that if we don't do anything, because anything we do is further empowering the energy. It's meeting the energy with the same energy. I don't like my anger. I've got to do something about it. It's meeting the anger of energy with the reaction of not wanting it. You see? And you'll see that again and again and again. And so are we going to meet this with the same energy? Are we going to just decondition? It has its point in psychology, because in deconditioning, for instance, if you're afraid of airplanes, I would have you picture being on an airplane and being relaxed rather than fearful. And over time, the relaxation response becomes conditioned to being on an airplane, so that when you get on the airplane the next time, in fact, you're not frightened. That's called desensitization or deconditioning the fear response with a different response, which is relaxation. In some ways, we're deconditioning the mind's response to be compelling to what it tells us we have to do. By doing nothing, we are now opening up a different option with that energy than the conditioned energy we have, which means that we have to do something about it. You see? So you can look at it a lot of different ways. All of it comes back to zero. So give it a try, and it's not that it doesn't go for a long period of time. Don't think that all I have to do is watch it once and it won't bounce back. None of us in this room believe that anymore, do we? All right, so it's because we're actually doing something If we completely did nothing to something, it would have very little shelf life. But because we're still struggling with not doing something, it still brings encouragement to the energy, even in a more subtle way. So as we learn our way out of that pattern and genuinely don't do anything, then the pattern peters out. Yes.
Rather than ask you a question, I'd rather add something.
Please.
Which is the dimension of anger and upset is a condition of closed heart, and then through meditating and resolving it becomes an open heart.
Okay, so we can look at it from open-hearted and closed-heartedness, which is a fine metaphor as well. See, we're just playing with different metaphors, different ways to go. Each one of us have a journey that in which one metaphor probably becomes predominant for a good part of the journey, and we can use that. Mine was death and dying. I used that metaphor for much of the journey of spiritual awakening, but open-hearted and closed-hearted. So let's just look at what an open heart looks like. An open heart, the word sensitivity sort of captures to me an open heart, doesn't it? Where we are available to life. We're open to life. Now, when we are sensitive, there is a conscious awareness of what is occurring. So an open heart is a conscious, aware being. Someone who's open-hearted is consciously aware of life as it's unfolding. Close heart, then, is an unconscious being. Now, these old patterns that come through us are unconscious. There, we've been so used to just giving over to them that we just give over to them unconsciously and let them pull us along. To bring sensitivity and open heart to that pattern means we have to feel it intimately in all of its subtlety, become conscious of it. We open our heart to it. And therefore, in that, we are no longer driven to be forced to abide and pretend that that's us. So that's a different metaphor, and a different way of looking at it. Both equally as good, equally as correct. Okay, enough for tonight? Thank you all very much.